Hi and welcome to the Last Man Standing show here with me, Paul Stevenson, on Republic Broadcasting Network. You can donate to the network, of course, by credit card or debit card on 512-246-9549 extension 3, or a toll-free 800-724-2719 extension 3. You can mail in checks, cash, money orders to RBN, 2251 Double Creek Drive, Suite 302, Round Rock, Texas 78664. Or if you click on the yellow button again on the Republic Broadcasting Network website, you'll see the various options to donate, including PayPal. So thank you for everyone to tuning in today. As I said, do try and keep us on the air by being as generous as you can be. I am joined with Patrick Slattery today. Thank you for joining me, Patrick. We've got a lot to get through. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
Yes, well, you're very welcome. Okay, so, yeah, just briefly, we talked about what we were going to talk about, and I thought we could talk about these protests which are breaking out in the United States. It started off in Columbia University, I believe, where there's big anti, well, I mean, it's been framed as anti-Israel pro. I heard one description in Fox News describing it as anti-Israel pro-Hamas. But I don't necessarily think it's either anti-Israel in some regards, and certainly not necessarily, maybe some, I guess, are who are pro-Hamas. I think it's more anti mass slaughter stroke genocide stroke ethnic cleansing, which is what most people who are protesting are there for. So you said it was a big deal. I think you're right. I think the Zionists have been consciously making an effort to suppress them, because I saw an article, I'm not exactly sure where I saw it, but I saw it as recently as yesterday, where the ADL themselves are lobbying to bring an end to these protests by bringing in the National Guard. And right on cue, we had the Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, talking about introducing possibly the National Guard to get control of these marches.
Wait a minute, I think his name is Dick Johnson.
Oh, Dick Johnson, yeah.
I mean, maybe it's Mike on his birth certificate, but everybody I know looks at him and says, that guy looks like a dick.
Okay, so we've had a parallel situation over here, where last week we spoke about Gideon Falter, who just happened to be leaving a synagogue and going for a stroll, and to happen to come upon one of these protests, pro-Palestinian protests. He happened to do that, of course, with a camera crew and his little skull cap on. And of course, the police, there was a major outrage because the police said, "You're openly Jewish," which I, you know, speculated he probably meant to say, "You're obviously Jewish." But this guy apparently accidentally came upon this protest with his skull cap and his camera crew, and just so happens to be the chief executive of Campaign Against Anti-Semitism. And of course, within a 48-hour period, if that, we had the mainstream media covering this ad infinitum and calling for an end to these protests and anti-Semitism. I mean, GB News, which again is the centrist types over here, been covering this at length. You know, if I look at the comments, the Gideon Falter in the past week has been exposed, because he was responsible for causing the very same treatment to Tommy Robinson when he came to support the march against anti-Semitism. So he's been exposed. But GB News, I think we can quite seriously now call them GB Jews. Anyway, it seems that the Zionists and the ADL and Campaign Against Anti-Semitism are panicking and bringing as much lobbying pressure and as much influence as they have, which is substantial, to bring an end to these protests.
They are. The protests, so ever since October 7th, there's been a certain amount of action going on in elite schools, and you know, colleges in general. And I spend a fair amount of time going, you know, on college campuses. I do go frequently. I was at NYU a couple of months ago. I've been at a bunch of other schools I was in Vanderbilt around New Year's, and you know, you walk around, and this was ever since October. You walk around and you see placards. Now, in October, placards or whatever you want to call them, handbills, and they're taped to electricity poles and billboards and whatnot. So you see all these homemade signs. And in October, you were seeing a lot of pro-Israel signs and a lot of pro-Palestinian signs. It was, and I, you know, I take some pictures for reference and send them to a few people. But what's been happening? The thing is, Israel's the pro-Israel people. Everything hinges on people looking at this with a starting date of October 7th. And an ending date of maybe October 7th or 8th. You have to look at it in just October 7th. That's the big thing, October 7th. Look what happened on October 7th. But the farther away we get from October 7th, the more people are able to look at what's happened since. And what's happened since is Israel has embarked on a kind of an orgasm of genocide. Where, and if those are crude words, sorry, but you know, they're killing 35,000-40,000 people randomly. It's obviously randomly. They haven't destroyed Hamas. If there was any if Hamas was being disproportionately targeted, then you wouldn't expect to have 50% females being killed and 30 and almost 50% children being killed. Some of the children are females. The death toll seems to be pretty much reflecting the demographics of Gaza. So the more October 7th is receding into irrelevance, or it's back in people's memory, and what's happened since then, but also what's happened before October 7th. People are able, at the farther we get from October 7th, the more people are able to focus on the decades of dispossession and ethnic cleansing and oppression that the Palestinians have been subjected to for the past seven decades. And so, and you're seeing this reflected. So, like I say, in October, you walk around on these schools and you'd see kind of like dueling placards, dueling billboards. But the farther away October 7th gets, the more the pro-Palestinian narrative and position is coming to dominate. And of course, a lot of, some of this, not all of America has a harsh winter, but a lot of places like Columbia and, Boston, Harvard's in Boston, Yale's in New Haven. These places have a winter. People aren't going to want to camp out in tents in January or February in New York or Boston. But in April, okay, so they started making these little tent encampments, and these have become a big issue. So there's that. I think it's there's a lot of things. I don't want to just go on for too long, but there's a lot of things that are causing noticing. So, for instance, a lot of these same students, these are students, these are people who, if they're undergrads, they're between, say, 18 and 22, they're graduate students, and there's some faculty that are involved that are somewhat older. And all of these people, 4 years ago, during the George Floyd Summer of Love, these people were at least teenagers, and they were going out to these the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, a lot of them, and they weren't themselves engaging in violence, but people around them wound, these peaceful protests in the daytime necessarily morphed into violent riots in the dusk. It'd get dark and they'd start getting very, very violent. Nobody was getting arrested. And now these people just simply camping out are being pretty brutally handled in some cases, and they're being arrested and they're having their futures ruined. So the contrast is very, very stark. You know, 4 years ago, not only were they not being arrested, but all the members of Congress were taking a knee and they were wearing, you know, African scarves, and the Black Lives Matter was able to shake down big corporations for millions and millions of dollars. Everything was like officially sanctioned and approved of. And now you've got, you know, Dick Johnson out there calling for the National Guard to be called in, and the media, from, you know, Fox News to MSNBC, everybody's condemning the students, and we got to stop this. And that this is causing noticing. And so and, you know, not a moment too soon. One last thing is the what's going on in Gaza. I mean, for the first time, you've had something that atrocious happening at a time when the means of recording it and disseminating the information is available, so people can actually see these images. This is a really crucial juncture in civilization, I think, because on the one hand, we now have the technology for the first time to really document this and spread it instantaneously. It can't be hidden. On the other hand, if you go forward maybe just a couple of years, the AI deepfakes and whatnot are going to become so pervasive that no matter what evidence you show people, nobody's going to believe anything anymore. So really, this is a critical juncture, and that's part of the reason that I think this is so important. So I'll kick it back to you now.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the parallels are stark, and I'd considered the parallels because a lot of these same people, and of course that causes some ambivalence on my part, because I recognize that a lot of these people, including the kind of language that they'll use, you know, I saw some interviews of these people at Columbia University and also in London, big marches in London yesterday. You know, they'll use the words that they are anti-colonialism and colonial powers. So obviously these are people, when they were at the Black Lives Matter marches, we wouldn't have had anything in common with their worldview. Very little anyway. I mean, I speak for myself, and I think probably for the most part yourself as well. And I think some of these people just like to go out on these protests. They're very angry kind of people or whatever else. But the Black Lives Matter protests were not so much about caring about Black people, but it was an opportunity to hate on and to suppress the white people, essentially. And it was an opportunity to aggressively espouse propaganda of white supremacy, you know, personified in Derek Chauvin and his behavior towards the victim that is George Floyd. However, we would then feel we do have something in common with these people when it comes to Israel, because like I said, I don't think you need to necessarily be anti-Israel. I think there are people, you know, well, I speak, you know, you look at people like Scott Ritter, he was essentially in quotes pro-Israel, but now is anti-Israel. So I don't think you need to be anti-Israel or pro-terrorism to be against what's happening in Gaza, which is why people like ourselves, who previously nothing in common with these people, could possibly see ourselves in one of these marches supporting their viewpoint, because the Palestinians have, unlike George Floyd and Black people in America in recent years, certainly, the Palestinians are genuinely oppressed by a murderous exterminationist regime. And, you know, I think the big difference, like you're talking about, at the time, because this was not for the cause of Black people, but it was an anti-white operation, it was not only allowed to continue, but it was encouraged, and there were no mass arrests. There was no aggression towards the protesters. So what's the difference here, Patrick? Why this time?
Well, and this is what people cannot avoid but asking themselves. So 2 years or 4 years ago, you know, they were out there and they were saying, we've got to smash white supremacy. Then this happened. And again, they were the same demonstrators were looking at this as white supremacy, that the Israelis were doing white supremacy at the Gazans. This is how they were framing it. But the response they're getting from the system is so much different. You know, it couldn't be more different. And, you know, the Jews, the Jewish powers that be, are really, really in a quandary. And they have come out and they're very, you know, very openly calling the students anti-Semitic, right? And the students weren't out there being anti-Semitic. They were out there being anti-white, doing with the exact same kind of rhetoric that, you know, white supremacy, racism, colonialism, all of this same stuff. But because the target is the Israeli military as opposed to the American police, all of a sudden, like, the response is completely different. And the Jews are calling it anti-Semitic. The Jews are turning it into a Jewish issue. And this I think will facilitate the demonstrators noticing what's going on. And I think the demonstrations are starting to, in response to being framed as anti-Semitic, I think the demonstrations are starting to take on more distinctly, maybe they are starting to become anti-Jewish and not strictly anti-Israel. Certainly they're anti-Zionist. And, you know, you've had instances where, you know, it's hard to tell because Jews are always going to play the anti-Semitism card. And so if you have a professor wearing a yarmulke, but he also wraps himself in an Israeli flag and they won't let him get past so he can get into the building and teach a class or something, then he calls that anti-Semitic. Whereas maybe the fact that he was Jewish didn't really matter, but, you know, they didn't care about his yarmulke, but they did care about the Israeli flag. But the Jews themselves are turning this into an issue of Jew. They're turning it into a Jewish issue and not simply an Israeli or Zionist issue. And I think they're playing their cards wrong, frankly, especially as when, you know, this is coming at a time when, I mean, these students are like Biden supporter type of students or anti-Trump type of students. But it's also coming at a time when amongst Trump supporters or former Trump supporters, people like Candace Owens and some people around her are starting to talk about Jewish power openly. So I think this is a massive crisis for Jewish power. And of course, it's coming during an election year when people are focused on politics and also where there are some very high profile events such as the Republican and Democratic National Conventions in the summertime in these big cities, and that could be really focal points for massive demonstrations bringing people from all over the country into the Democrats are having their convention in Chicago, the Republicans in Milwaukee. And then, you know, in advance of that, in June, Charlie Kirk's organization called Turning Point USA, they're having, for whatever reason, they're having their own annual shindig in Detroit. Detroit, why Detroit? I don't know. But because they're having it in Detroit, Nick Fuentes' group, which kind of, what's the word for it? They like to troll. They have a history of trolling Charlie Kirk's group. They're having their annual meeting in Detroit, too, at the exact same time. And so, I mean, that could be kind of a preliminary scene for all sorts of shenanigans. We'll see what happens. But I think we're going to really see, I could be wrong, but I think we're going to see a lot of drama over the next few months.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned Candace Owens there. I think since October 7th, I think you've seen a distinctive shift in what would be your your average American nationalist, a Trump supporter, America First, and I've noticed it in the UK as well, where they would normally have, you know, and I think for many it's a blind spot, it's an unchallenged assumption that we stand by Israel. You're seeing a split here because of people like Candace Owens and Tucker Carlson. You're now seeing a lot of people who would have been previously America Firsters and stroke we must stand by Israel, our greatest ally, who are now very much either questioning this misguided loyalty to Israel, or who are outright against it. So you're now having this, you know, identification of the distinction between actual American First and, you know, Israel First. And of course, Donald Trump himself is very much, you know, America First, but in brackets, really Israel First, really. And so you're seeing that split, which is a great thing. And again, people like Candace Owens and more so Tucker Carlson, you know, have been condemning Israel and have identified it as not being in the American interest to be aligned with and funding this regime. And I've noticed, not on the talking heads on GB News, for example, over here, very centrist right types that I talk about a lot. I'm not talking about the usual absolute mainstream media, but these guys are, I call them mainstream media light. I mean, they like to see themselves as being a, you know, some sort of reaction to mainstream media, but they're completely Zionist controlled and they're very aggressively pro-Israel. So, but if you look in the comments, now I don't know if these people are actually going to get to the point where they start looking at Jewish power in general, but when you look at the comments, they are certainly becoming way more anti-Israel and have become way more aware of what Israel actually is and how we don't want to be associated with them. There's no love in the comments for what Israel's doing and Israel generally. So that's a very, very good thing. And the other thing, I mean, you know, you're seeing these same types of people, the far-right free speech types, and, you know, that sort of network who have, you know, spent the last 8-10 years mocking, you know, the libtards for their safe spaces and how they can't handle free speech and how they need safe spaces and how they're snowflakes. Suddenly, these people are not so keen on free speech and they're constantly whinging about the poor Jews, you know, who have to listen to this anti-Israel, pro-Palestinian stuff on the college campuses. All of a sudden now, you know, it's been turned on its head. These people really, if they're honest, they want to start censoring the whole pro-Palestine argument, and are now essentially guilty of what they've been accusing the West or the left of for the last 8 to 10 years. It's incredible, but I guess we shouldn't be surprised. But you know, these slogans, for example, like from the river to the sea, a slogan, by the way, that Netanyahu himself recently used as to how he sees the future of Israel. But when the Palestinians use that, that is seen as language of terrorism, and they're constantly, even the placards at these rallies in London, the pro-Israelis, they have, you know, the Zionist placards are Hamas are terrorists. And, you know, this is always the argument from these people like Farage. You know, they have, almost every conversation, you know, starts off when they interview someone about, you know, talking about this issue between Palestine. If someone comes on who's pro-Palestinian in any way, you get almost invariably in the first minute, if it's not the first question, is, do you support Hamas terrorism? You know, this is constantly their line, you know.
Yeah. And of course, I'm aware that in Britain, if you say anything that seems pro Hamas, you might get just thrown in jail. So, I mean, anyway, I do think this is a huge deal. And I think the people who are out there demonstrating, people have a variety of reasons. And there are a fair number of Jews who are out there demonstrating. And, you know, some people question their motivation. And I think, you know, there's a variety here. You have some people who simply have enough humanity where they look at this and, you know, some Jewish people, they have enough humanity where they look at it and say, this is wrong. I think you have other people, Jewish people, who look at it and say, this is a bad look for the Jews. And so I oppose this because it's bad for the Jews. I mean, there's some of that too. And that's, you know, it's different to say I oppose it because that's inhumane. And and then on the other hand, to say I oppose it because it reflects badly on my people and it will be harmful to my people. So I think there's that. There may well be I would think it's rather small, but, you know, I'm not denying the possibility it could exist. Some Jews out there who are kind of being provocateurs, some Jews who actually want to make not so much that they're worried about the Israelis looking bad, but or to the extent they're worried about the Israelis looking bad, they want to make the demonstrators look worse. And, you know, whenever you see stories about protesters, say, blocking the Brooklyn Bridge, or, you know, creating massive inconvenience for regular normal people, people just trying to get to work or whatnot. So far, every time I see stories like that, when I read, it's you know, Jewish Voices for Peace or something like that. And I have met Jewish Voices for Peace, and I don't think that they're necessarily like evil controlled opposition, but they do right now they seem to be involved in actions where they're disrupting normal people's lives. And honestly, if you want to disrupt anyone's lives and you're in New York, go block the entrance to the Israeli consulate, you know, block the entrance to you know, B'nai B'rith or the Zionist Organization of America. Don't block the entrance to the to Union Station so people can't commute to work. So there's that bad look. But, you know, I think a lot of Jews recognize that this, you know, that the policy that Israel's taking is extremely self-destructive. And so probably the bulk of the Jews who are involved in the protests, and they're a fair number, I think are probably motivated because they think that the Israeli policy is bad for the Jews, and they genuinely oppose the Israeli policy primarily because it's bad for the Jews rather than because it's bad for the people of Gaza.
Yeah,
that's my.
Yeah, you're probably right. And yeah, you know, I find it interesting because I've always maintained that, you know, the best predictor of future or, you know, future behavior is past behavior. And when you look, and I'm talking generally here, but when you look generally historically, again, I'm not going to get into the nuances of it here because it's not that simple. But in one sense, I think it's a reasonable position to take, looking at it historically, largely. When you've had the equivalent of European elites, for example, you know, aristocrats who have courted Jews as middlemen, as they often took that role, but they provided lots of funding to various kings and queens or whatever over the centuries in Europe.
Thank you.
supported Jews as middlemen, as they often took that role, but they provided lots of funding to various kings and queens or whatever over the centuries in Europe. And they do so up until a point, until there are problems with the people. And usually the people will identify Jews as having a very subversive, destructive impact on the culture. And so said kings, said aristocrats, when the heat gets too intense, when the uprising of the populations becomes too intense and too negative, well, then they'll turn on the Jews. And I do wonder, how long is it before the great, you know, advantage of Zionist lobby groups like AIPAC and others, which are decisive and imperative for campaign funding, becomes a complete hot potato? Because how much money do you need, unless you're rigging the elections, which of course the particularly the Democrats are capable of, but how much money do you need to overcome complete hatred of your candidates? I mean, this cannot go on. So in other words, when do the likes of Joe Biden and his political campaigners say, look, this issue is now, this support from Israel, this funding from Israel is completely counterproductive and untenable now. We need to distance ourselves from these people. You know, I think that's around the corner if this continues, which is why the Zionists are panicking, and they're playing into their enemies' hands by trying to suppress. Because what are they doing? They are now attempting to conduct suppression and aggression against these people at the universities, and all this is going to do is cause more solidarity with the Palestinians, because they're going to say, now they're doing it to us in the college campuses. Okay, they're not killing and starving us, but they're doing everything they can to suppress us just like the Palestinians. All it's going to do is explode in their face, you know?
Right, and this is happening. So within the Biden administration, within the State Department, within the National Security Council, they've really got other fish to fry. And you know, I think certainly Victoria Nuland, who's not in the State Department anymore, her top priority was trying to overthrow Russia, overthrow the Russian government. And now there seems to be a shift. They, you know, they got rid of Victoria Nuland. They replaced her with this guy, Kurt Campbell, who is a China hawk. And you had a week ago, you had Janet Yellen. She had been in China making demands that they change their economy so they don't produce so much. Stop making so much money, guys. Come on. It's bad for you. And then this past week, you had Anthony Blinken over there, who's really kind of issuing threats. And so
why in China, as you do.
Yeah. And so this seems to be the direction they want to move in, and a war with Iran or general Middle East war, even though, you know, Yellen and Blinken are Jews, they've actually got other priorities right now. You know, just because they're Jews doesn't necessarily mean that they want to start nuclear Armageddon so that somebody can butcher a red cow, you know, abuse, torture a red cow at a you know, torn down mosque. That's not necessarily their priority. So within the Biden administration, first and foremost, these people who are demonstrating in the campuses and the people who have sympathy for them are the people that the Biden administration absolutely depends on for votes, because, you know, the elections can cheat, but you can only cheat so much before it just gets completely obvious. And you know, it was bad enough last time. It was obvious enough last time. But if all these people who actually did support the Democrats and did vote for the Democrats last time aren't even going to show up and vote for them, not that they would vote for Trump, but they wouldn't have to show up, or they could vote for the Green Party, or they could vote for someone else. That, you know, that's a death knell for the Biden administration. And if Trump were smart, which he is not being smart nowadays. I mean, sometimes maybe he has some good instincts, but he can be pretty retarded too. And if he were smart, he would either just continue making the vaguest of statements. This never would have happened if I were president. It would never happen. Or he'd be, critical of Israel if he were smart. But, you know, just if he just said, kept his mouth shut and talked about other stuff and you know, when need be, just said this would have never happened if I were president, the people on the college campuses that say, you know, it doesn't matter, it's Biden and Trump, they're both Zionists, they're both horrible. But over the past couple of weeks, it seems that Trump is starting to stake out the pro-Israel position. Well, he might think he's got nothing to lose because his own people, his own base of white boomers are pro-Israel. So he thinks he has nothing to lose, but he has a lot to lose, because if he distinguishes himself from Biden and turns Biden into Hamas Joe, right, then the
genocide Joe.
But Hamas Joe, right, rather than genocide Joe, Hamas Joe. Right. If he turns and you know, Trump is the pro-Israel candidate, if he distinguishes himself in this way, then the logic of the kids who are so appalled by Biden changes. It's like, well, Biden's bad, but if Trump comes in, oh, my God. And then, you know, they go back to being Biden voters just to stop Trump. So it's retarded for Trump to do this, but he has a history of being retarded.
Well, not to mention, we've just talked about, he might find that his base is not as pro-Israel as they were 6 or 8 months ago. Right. And the other thing that Trump, in my opinion, predictably did and shows he hasn't changed one bit, is essentially, then you can speculate as to what the reasons were, or you can speculate as to how much impact negatively or otherwise it'll have on him. But he buckled on the funding for this 95 billion and the 61 billion that was for Ukraine. He buckled on that because apparently he gave his blessing for that in the end, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
So the man can't seem to be able to stick to his guns. When the pressure becomes too much, he tends to give in. Now, I don't think it's ultimately going to affect him that much, but it shows you that he hasn't changed a lot. But before we go on to Russia, Patrick, I just wanted to talk a little bit more about, you know, I saw the, you know, there really is an ideological dog's dinner in many ways, because when you look at the marches in London, you know, you speculated as to the motives of Jews, you know, being anti-Israel and pro-Palestinian. And I agree with you. I think there are some of them who believe that it's just an act of tremendous evil that's going on, and they're pushing against it. Others maybe, you know, more doing what the other way you suggested, they think it's bad for Jews. But yesterday it was funny because you're seeing these ultra-Orthodox Jews, and one must admit that the ultra-Orthodox Jews, they do get a hard time in Israel to some extent, because they are different. I mean, they, you know, they're not the secular Zionists, and there is a divide between these people in some level. So you're seeing these ultra-Orthodox Jews with their quite comical sort of garb on, their clothes and all that stuff that they wear, and they're on the pro-Palestinian side, and they've got quite sort of high-pitched, strange little voices, these particular Jews, and they're shouting over at the Zionist and all the Israeli flags, shouting, calling them anti-Semites. And then you go over to the other side, and, you know, typically, predictably, along with, you know, the 95%, you know, Star of David Israeli flags, you'll see, a handful of Union Jacks and King George flags aligning themselves with Israel, which, again, I find ironic because, you know, these people are considering themselves to be British nationalists, but yet, again, they support a second foreign state. And then I think it was Sky News or The Independent who were there doing filming. And two of the people that they interviewed, now bearing in mind there's thousands of people here, and it was only later I thought, how did they find these two guys? I mean, anyway, two of them were Jews. Easy enough, I imagine, to find some Jews, and you know, that's interesting. Oh, look, the Jews, and we speculate as to, you know, their motives. But the media seemed to, like, in this particular clip, which was, it wasn't 2 minutes, it was about 15 minutes long, there was like two interviews with two Jewish guys, you know, that who were on the pro-Palestinian side. But, and yet, one of them, who looked about 70, was a Holocaust survivor. I'm like, Holocaust survivor, mate, you look about 70. And another one they happened to find in this crowd was the son of a Holocaust survivor. In amongst thousands of people, in this huge, you know, multitude of people, you would almost think that every third or fourth person that you met was a Holocaust survivor or someone who was related to a Holocaust survivor. I just find it incredible, and it's just they just happened to find these two guys. Just give us your thoughts on that. Am I right to think cynical? Are these people, were they, was this prearranged? Because let's face it, it's not that easy to find so many Holocaust survivors. And I also find it interesting just how many Holocaust survivors there are today when you consider the messaging and the narrative about the absolute ruthlessness and, you know, extent of the evil of the National Socialists, that so many of these Holocaust people survived, you know?
Yeah, the definition of Holocaust survivor that's used in the United States is anybody, any Jew who was in any part of Europe that that at any time was occupied by Axis power. So I guess that would be almost all of Europe, with the exception of like Spain and Portugal, maybe, and Ireland and England. If you were...
It's a much wider net than having to sort of at Auschwitz, right?
Yeah, and so if you were in Europe at any time between 1933 and 1945, that you were a Holocaust survivor. Well, you know, a lot of Goy were in Europe between 1943 and 1945. Hey, my parents didn't die in the Holocaust. Did that make them Holocaust survivors? I don't know. You know, they weren't Jews, obviously. But yeah, it's a very, very wide net, and doesn't, when you get down to it, it doesn't mean a lot. But you know, if that's
what's the
definition,
what is the media's angle for you know, picking these Holocaust survivors to comment how they're pro-Palestinian?
I don't know.
I don't think it's necessarily pro-Jewish or certainly pro-Israel, because I think from that point of view, and again, a lot of the press in our country are, you know, leftist, and of course, a lot of the nationalists in our country don't recognize that a lot of this type of stuff is also funded and pushed by Jews, as much as they are now aware of Zionist power, but the messaging was still not pro-Israel. Well, you know, it's like...
I got one idea. So... what Israel is doing, we've never seen anything like this. Now, in the 1930s and the 1940s, whatever was happening, and people might have various ideas, various opinions about what happened, whatever was happening, you weren't able to see it because they didn't have, everybody wasn't walking around with a high resolution camera in their pocket. Ready to
it's a shame
they weren't. At that time. And there was, huh?
It's a shame like, they weren't, because I don't think this narrative of World War II would prevail so much, unquestionably prevail to the extent that it does today.
Right. But I'm just saying, people weren't walking around with that. So we've never seen anything like this before. So I think for Jews to be at a demonstration being interviewed and then to invoke the Holocaust. I'm a Holocaust survivor and I oppose this. Okay, well, you oppose it, but you're also invoking the Holocaust. And by invoking the Holocaust, you're invoking an event that supposedly trumps all events in history. So it turns Jews from being the perpetrators of atrocities to being the victim of an even bigger atrocity. So it kind of, it helps like balance the scales for Jews. Mm. If you're, you know, opposing what Israel's doing now, but you're invoking the Holocaust at the same time.
Yeah, well, especially if you couple it with the narrative that's constantly coming out of Zionist media that the Jews have the right to defend themselves, and the whole Middle East is hell-bent on, wiping Israel off the map. It's almost like, it's almost subtly trying to throw in maybe a little justification.
Well, I mean, the Jews are really that worried about anti-Semitism, why does it seem like they're doing everything in their power to make people hate them? If they're so worried about anti-Semitism, why don't they just try acting like normal human beings?
Yeah, exactly. Well, this is all happening, of course, while they look like they're on the verge of a full-scale invasion of Rafah. And of course, over there, it's not like any of this has caused them to pull back at all. I mean, there has been more crimes perpetrated, and a huge crime, which is, again, very embarrassing for them, with peoples who constantly invoke the Holocaust and other victimhood narratives, where this hospital has exposed, I think, 300 mass graves. A lot of them, again, men or women and children, and women and people who've had their hands tied behind their back before they were slaughtered. And then there's mass graves exposed on this. Now, one of the Labour MPs in Parliament during the week brought up this topic to the Deputy Prime Minister, Oliver Dowden. And she said, why is there such a, more or less, paraphrasing, why when there was, when the Russians committed this mass atrocity and mass graves in Bucha, was there such condemnation? And yet when we see a similar mass grave being exposed by the Israelis, that we continue to support them, and isn't this justification to stop exporting arms? And I kid you not, but the response from the Deputy Prime Minister Oliver Dowden was as such, and I quote, "Well, of course we would expect the democratic government of Israel to investigate allegations of misconduct." I think it goes beyond misconduct when you expose a mass grave. "And that's exactly what they're doing. And I find it extraordinary," he said, "that the deputy, right honourable lady should seek to draw parallels between the legitimate war of self-defence of Israel and the conduct of Russia." So they get a pass because apparently democratic governments are not capable of such a thing. And they're certainly, and later even on to say, we can trust the Israeli government to investigate themselves. So this is back to what we were saying. This is like affording a serial killer the grace and, the license to investigate his own crimes. And after he's investigated them, to be the judge and jury of the outcome of said serial killer crimes. It really is incredible. And by the way, this government in Israel is led up by Benjamin Netanyahu, who the Israelis want to get rid of and imprison for corruption. But yet Oliver Dowden here ensures that there's no similarity here between Russia and Israel, that they're a democratic government and we can entrust them to investigate this, and we trust them to do so,
Right. There's a commercial on RBN. I don't like to talk about RBN commercials, but some guy comes on and says, "Did you know that the IRS admits the federal income tax is collected by voluntary compliance?" Well, I'm just raising that because I want to focus on the voluntary compliance. Did you know that the Jewish domination of our society is only possible because of the voluntary compliance of the populations? We don't have guns held to our heads. Now, we voluntarily comply because we're brainwashed and we don't understand anything. And the truth is kept from us and all of this. But what's going on right now is just so blatant, and it's getting harder and harder to masquerade the truth. And if they can't disguise the truth, then that voluntary compliance that goes by the wayside. And without that voluntary compliance, there's no more Jewish domination of our societies. I think there's a real crisis point. And, I can't guarantee that it's going to end with a at least a significant downsizing of Jewish power. But if I had to bet, I would bet that it's going to that over the next couple of years, we're going to see like Israel is going to lose
their wings really
significantly. And I think Jewish power in our societies is also going to wane significantly. I hope so, at least.
Yeah, maybe Jewish power, and particularly, Zionist lobbying power, we're going to see a mowing of the lawn, if we can ironically use that phrase. Maybe the Jews and their power is going to have a, let's mow the lawn on Jewish power over the next few years. I definitely think they're going to have their wings clipped because, they have exponentially accelerated this process that might otherwise have taken another 30 or 40 years.
Yeah. Well, we're almost out of time.
Yeah, we're out of time. It's a shame. I wanted to get to some of the stuff with Russia, but maybe we can do a show in the week, Patrick, and discuss that, because obviously I wanted to talk about some of the things there, particularly the Kiev regime now calling for the embassies not to give Ukrainians abroad passports to young men so that they're forced to return. But we can get to all that next week. All right. Well, listen, thank you for joining me again. And as I say, we can catch up in the week, hopefully. And thank you, everyone, for listening. And I'll be back again next week. So until then, take care and God bless.